Today on the 21st Show, tens of thousands of journalists across the country dedicate their lives to facts, uncovering information, verifying whether it's true, and reporting it to the public. Many of our fellow Americans, however, do not get their information from the news, but rather from the people around them. A new book explores how that information changes as we talk about it, how it changes us, and what all that means for our politics. It's called Through the Grapevine. We'll talk about it with the author, Taylor Carlson. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL Urbana, WUIS Springfield, WGLT Normal, WNIJ Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK Quad Cities, and WSIU Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. When we sit down around the Thanksgiving table later this week, a lot of us, at one point or another, will probably talk politics. No matter how much we try to avoid the subject, especially this year.
After a tiring and sometimes trying season, many Americans are preparing to pull up a chair at the final election battleground, the Thanksgiving dinner table.
64% of Americans say election-related stress is impacting their holiday plans. The Spruce survey includes 2,000 people from all 50 states. Also shows 23% of respondents are thinking about skipping Thanksgiving altogether.
Before the election, that was the main topic with everyone. Now that the results are over, until President-elect Trump is in office and we see what he's really gonna do, there's not too much to talk about.
Suit yourself. All right, beyond the Thanksgiving table, maybe the conversation should not be so much about whether we talk about politics, but instead about how we talk about politics, especially in an age where social media makes it easier than ever to have those conversations. For all the analysis about news headlines or how much various outlets spend talking about any given issue, maybe what matters more is what we tell each other and what that means for how we think about politics. And that leads to a much bigger question. What does all of this mean for our democracy? All of that is the subject of a new book, Through the Grapevine, Socially Transmitted Information and Distorted Democracy. Its author is Taylor N. Carlson, who's also an associate professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis, where her work focuses on political psychology and communication. She joins me now for the hour. Taylor Carlson, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, you can join the conversation today about our political conversations by calling 800-222-9455. Where do you get your news other than NPR? How much do you learn about political news from places other than mass media? And how do you deal with the barrage of information and sometimes misinformation and disinformation on social media? Let us know at 800-222-9455. All right, Taylor, you start the book with a quote from Thomas Jefferson complaining that someone, quote, who never looks into a newspaper is better informed than he who reads them, inasmuch as he who knows nothing is nearer to the truth than he whose mind is filled with falsehoods and errors. You draw a through line from that to former and future President Donald Trump's tirades on fake news, but how much of a role does mass media really play in getting information out into the world?
Thanks. So this is a really important question and one that scholars have been really interested in for a long time. And actually, if we look back in kind of the history of research on media effects, for example, there's been a lot of debate here. So there was one point in time where scholars were really concerned about the effects that mass media could be having on the public, and here I'm talking mostly about research focused in American politics. It could be quite different in other contexts.
Yeah, but one of my college textbooks was called "Do the Media Govern?" Right, probably.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
In that vein. Yeah,
exactly. Right, and so there's this concern that that mass media was out there to to brainwash the public, right? And that it was serving this role instead of being sort of the fourth arm of government as sort of this watchdog on government, it was instead manipulating the public. And then there was some empirical evidence that maybe mass media was having this influence on shaping public opinion. It could be through setting the agenda, right? What the media talks about is then what people are learning about and what they think is important, things like that. Or it could be through the way that media is actually covering certain topics, right? Or inserting opinion instead of just delivering facts, things like that. But these are really difficult things to study because just in the example I gave, right, in thinking about agenda setting, if we think that if media talks about something, then everyone else thinks it's important, then sure, it could be the case that media is pulling public opinion, right? And media is causing the public to think that a given topic is important. But it could also be the case that media is simply covering what journalists think the public wants to hear, right? And so they sort of can, through interviews with people on the ground or whatever, you know, they know what the public thinks is important, and they're going to talk about what the public wants to hear. And so it's actually the public driving what the media covers. And so these are things that are really difficult to disentangle empirically. And so really having a firm grip on the effects that media has on shaping public opinion is really difficult. And so it's hard to sort of say definitively, yes, of course, the media matters, or yes, of course, media is driving opinion and things like that. And I think this is also hard to talk about because I think a lot of us have our own conceptions of how this works, right? Like we watch the news and we say, oh my gosh, look at the bias we just saw. Or we say, oh my gosh, how can you not watch the news? How are you so willing to bury your head in the sand and not pay attention to what's going on in the world? We have our own conceptions of how we should engage with information and where we should be getting information, that it's then hard to kind of accept the reality that these are really hard questions to answer. And it's at least from a scientific standpoint. So I think there's a lot of mixed evidence out there on whether and how the media can affect public opinion. And I think that is part of what inspired a lot of the work it put into this book, was sort of thinking about these competing trends, right, where we see like increased access to news over time, but decreased attention to news, and decreased interest in news, decreased trust in news, yet people seem to be having a rough idea of what's going on in the world. And so trying to figure out then, okay, if people are not getting it from mass media directly, where are people picking up on some of these cues?
Well, so that's a great question. That actually leads into where I was going to go. So what do we understand about where people are getting information about politics?
Yeah. And so this is also a little bit tricky because we can look at a lot of behavioral data now, right? We do have some trace data where we can directly observe online the websites people go to, and we can look at web traffic. We can trace a lot of this through digital footprints. We can trace a lot of this through TV viewership and things like that. But a lot of this still really relies on survey data and asking people, where do you learn about politics? And I don't know about you, and maybe it's just because I have 3 kids under 5 right now, but like if you ask me what I had for breakfast or what I watched or what I read yesterday, I probably couldn't give you a very good answer. And so thinking about, you know, where do you get your news? Like that's a hard question for some people to answer. And I think especially when people have different conceptualizations of what counts as news, what counts as information, things like that. But that said, when we do look at the survey data here, TV is still a dominant source, particularly among older age demographics. But we are seeing an increasing number of people turning to social media for news. And we do see that about a third of Americans report that they bump into the news or encounter it from other people through word of mouth instead of trying to seek it out directly themselves.
The group chat, right? I'm in a group chat with some former, current and former reporters. Honestly, I could probably get more interesting links there than I do from just about any other source these days.
Sure. Yeah.
So I guess, okay, your book argues that it, at least in the field of political science, we talk about how information passes around society. And we don't really talk as much about how the information changes. So talk a little bit about the ways that, you know, it's one thing, you know, back in the day, somebody would pick up a newspaper, maybe they'd read the headline, they'd read the story, maybe they'd read part of the story. Newspaper stories were written in such a way that you could just read the beginning of it and kind of get the gist. How does information go around today and what happens to it as it travels?
Right. So I think in many ways, actually, this probably hasn't changed very much over time from the newspaper days to today. But I argue in the book that information becomes sparse, biased, less accurate, and mobilizing. And what that means is, by sparse, I mean you're just getting less of the information. So if you read, a newspaper article or an article you read online, or maybe you listen to this show and then you're so excited about it, you want to go tell everyone else about it, about what you heard, right? You might, we've got an hour's worth of content here on the show. You might only be able to remember a handful of bits of information of what we talked about today. Or you might only remember a couple of pieces of information from a news article that you read. So you're going to get less information being transmitted. That's not super surprising. But what's more interesting then is that the little information that does get passed on tends to also be biased in favor of your preferences. So if you read a news article about the election and you were happy with the result or something like that, you might pull away details that are really exciting and like talk well about your candidate, and that's what you're going to pass on. And you might do the opposite if you were unhappy about the election, right? You're going to pick apart details that make your side look good, and that's what you pass on to other people.
We kind of see a real world example of this now. Maybe you think it's different, but you know, I look at all the various Democratic explanations of why they lost, right? It's not enough focus on the working class. We heard from Bernie Sanders, too much focus on social justice. The racial reckoning went too far, you know, LGBT issues, whatever it is. People hear what they want to hear and pass along and focus on those parts.
Right, exactly. And I think this is one sort of term we use for this is motivated reasoning, or you might have heard like confirmation bias or some of these other cognitive biases that lead us to seek out information that confirms our prior beliefs to begin with. But then even after sort of getting that information that is already consistent with your prior beliefs, then we might be likely to then share that information with others. And I find some evidence for this in the book. And then information becomes less accurate. And here, this is not necessarily people sort of intentionally fabricating information, right? Or trying to create misinformation, but it could just be you simply misremember details or have a couple of mistakes in what you recall. But it can happen, it tends to happen in ways that, again, continue to sort of make your side look better, right? So this is not random noise in the decrease in accuracy. It is bias in favor of your particular political leanings. And finally, that information becomes mobilizing. And this is kind of the really tricky spot where I think you have people passing on information that is sort of bundled in a way now that is, it's sparse, it's biased, and it's less accurate. And at the same time that you're sort of giving someone else this package of information that's kind of tattered from the original version, you're also asking them to do something with that information. So you're saying, okay, now go vote. Now go contact your legislator. Now go do these things to get involved in politics. And normally we would think that encouraging political engagement would be good. And in some ways, it very well can be. And even with this socially transmitted information, it still can have these positive benefits. But if we think that people should be acting based on accurate, reliable, unbiased information, then this sort of starts to break down if we think that that is an important sort of prerequisite to engagement. And I'm not saying that it is, but it's sort of if that is a value or something that someone has, then it starts to lead us to, I think, question a little bit the importance of how this information is changing through this diffusion chain.
That's very interesting because I've done something in recent years when I do share something on social media. I will try to just pull like a quote from the article and post that and not add any commentary. And I guess I hadn't really thought through exactly why I might have been doing that. I guess I'm sort of instinctually as a reporter trying to work against some of the things you're talking about, right? People adding their own little thoughts to things or putting calls to action on these ideas. All right, we're going to take a break. We are talking with Taylor Carlson, who's a professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis and the author of the book Through the Grapevine, Socially Transmitted Information and Distorted Democracy. We're talking about the ways that information moves through our society now and the effects that is having, the distorting effects that's having on our democracy. We'll talk a little more about that. I've got a real-world case example that came up where I live in Illinois in the last week or so. And we want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also email us anytime, talk@21stshow.org. And before we go to break, I'll mention you can now find our program on YouTube among all your other favorite podcast platforms. Just search for Illinois Public Media. All right, more to come with Taylor Carlson on Through the Grapevine after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For the entire program today, we are talking about news and information and the way it travels in our democracy presently and how the way it travels through our democracy can distort our democracy and what that means for the project of American self-government. We're talking about this with Taylor Carlson, who's the author of the book Through the Grapevine, Socially Transmitted Information and Distorted Democracy. She's also professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. If you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Taylor, I want to share a recent example from my own life. My wife was scrolling Facebook the other day, came across a message from a neighborhood group we used to live in. And I'm not going to use any names here, but this was posted by someone who said, you know, I think I'm just going to read it, actually, what this message said. It has this huge image that says urgent message with a red megaphone and the exclamation point in the triangle, the warning sign. And it says, from a friend. From my cousin, so-and-so, her husband is a lead detective in Springfield, spreading the word that the Venezuelan gang members are in Springfield, at least 20 staying at Red Roof Inn. They've been stealing from ATMs, Walmarts, and cars. The city arrested two yesterday driving a stolen car, but let right out. Be extra alert everywhere. Chicago ran out of housing, so they've spread out. Tell all your girlfriends. These people are really dangerous. I got this from my neighbor. Be careful. So to me, and to my wife, fortunately, this jumped out as like a number of issues here. That's like from a friend, from a cousin whose husband is a detective, but also from a neighbor. Anyway, the Springfield Police Department got word of this, put out a news release debunking these claims. You know, as with anything, there are some kernels of truth, right? There were two guys arrested for a stolen car, which is the kind of thing that happens all the time. Somebody else stole an ATM from a business. There might have even been a couple of those. But this idea that there are you know, 20 quote unquote Venezuelan gang members staying at a hotel seems to have no basis in reality. So I just wonder, as you hear that, this is the sort of thing that struck me as like, oh, this is a perfect case study for some of the things you're talking about.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And, you know, of course, this is the first I've heard of the case.
Sure. And you don't have to comment on the specific one, but yeah.
Sure. Yeah. But yeah, I think, and one thing that I think is interesting is that, you know, you highlighted this is from a neighbor or from a cousin, from a friend, from a neighbor, whatever. They're sort of
all
tracing
of
that
above.
Chain for
yeah.
you. But I think what's interesting there too is they're really highlighting the relationships, right? And I think what they might be trying to do, and why I think some of these types of groups with information sharing can be so powerful, is when information comes from someone you know, you might be more likely to trust it. And I find in some of my work, this is in the book, but it does not play as prominent of a role in the book as I think it perhaps should have. But the number one reason that I find that people choose to rely on the news for information is because they don't trust other people. They trust media. But also the number one reason that people choose to rely on their friends for information instead of the news is because they don't trust the news and they trust their friends instead. So this trust component is really, really important for where people are choosing to learn about what's going on in their communities, what's going on in the world. And so I think that in this particular case, especially because it sounds like it was talking about something very local, very localized, right? You can see how, first of all, people might be very interested in it because it seems like it could immediately affect them, right? It's in their community, in their backyard, as opposed to thinking about something like high-level national politics or even international politics. But they're really highlighting this, like, this is affecting me, this is affecting you, we are all in this together, and this is something you can rely on because I got it from someone that I trust, and you should trust me, right? And thinking about this role that trust can play in how we value the information that is communicated to us. And I think this is where some of the degradation in information through social transmission can be kind of sneaky, where we think we're talking to someone who is, you know, maybe more knowledgeable about an issue than us, or we might not know their political leanings or whatever it may be. So we don't think that they're going to be biased, right? Like, we might think that, oh, all media are biased, all media have their slants one way or the other, but my friends sure don't. Right? Like, my friends can filter that out. And we don't necessarily think that that our friends can sort of also operate like the biased media that we're trying to avoid, for example. And so I think that's interesting to think about. And it's interesting that, you know, just in your retelling of this case study, you're really highlighting the relationships down the chain, which I think is interesting.
And contradictory, I'll add again. And, you know, other little things that jumped out at me, and I actually, we reached out to the Springfield Police Department. I had a chat with a deputy chief there yesterday about this episode. You know, the thing said, so yeah, there is this sort of chain of custody, which I guess to me was suspicious here in like how many people mm-hmm. were named as being the source, but maybe, as you're saying, to other people that lends it credibility. Also this idea that someone is a lead detective in Springfield, based on the name that was here, there are no detectives with the Springfield Police Department who are married to people with that name. On the other hand, Springfield is home to at least a dozen different police agencies. There are smaller towns here. The state police is based here. Other state police agencies, federal law enforcement has a presence here. So just things like that make it sort of difficult to parse this. But so you brought up this question of trust, and I do think this is very interesting and really one of the roots of our problems in our society now. And we asked members of our texting group about where they get their information. And Stephen in Urbana had something to say about this and the idea that whether the media should be trusted. And maybe for context, I'll say that the way we framed the question to our text group was, We began by saying thousands of journalists dedicate their lives to uncovering, verifying, and reporting facts, but many of our fellow Americans get their news not from the press, but from the people around them. Stephen was not a fan of that framing. He said, "I find your statement gratuitous and self-serving. In my opinion, journalists have largely failed the American people in the past several years by providing opinion rather than factual news and capitulating to corporate interests, ratings, and sensationalism. People have been left to choose what are facts and what aren't. Truth has been abandoned. Journalists have done a huge disservice to the public," end quote. Thanks for your candor, Stephen. Taylor, what do you think of that in this sense that the media is changing? How is all that tied up with how we get our information?
Sure. So first of all, I also want to thank Stephen for, it was Stephen, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. For sharing that perspective. I think a lot of times, especially in these types of conversations, and I don't know this text chat, but I think it can be easy to sort of, censor views and things like that. And so I think it's, but I think that's wrong for having open dialogue. So I really appreciate the perspective and really sharing that. And I think there are a lot of people who share Stephen's perspective. And I think that there is something to be said for that, right? And so I think there are a lot of people who think that there is more opinion in media today, and there are empirical studies of this, and there is empirical evidence looking at shifts over time in the way news is covered, and there is empirical evidence looking at how content changes when, like based on the market demands and market incentives that are out there. So I think there's a lot. I think Stephen, in many ways, is certainly not wrong in some of the realities and how the media landscape has changed over time. And I think that makes an uphill battle for journalists to try to do the good things. Like, I think that there are certainly journalists who are out there trying to be that watchdog of the government and to be those objective, unbiased reporters. And I think it must be exhausting to try to do this job, but know that you're trying to win over a public that doesn't trust that you have their best interest at heart in your reporting and things like that. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I would say the thing I struggle with in these conversations is that the media is me. Frankly, it's my colleagues at Illinois Public Media. It's also Pete Hegseth on Fox News morning show. It's, Anderson Cooper. Maybe it's Joe Rogan for some people. That's the media. And so it's a term that's really almost like, I think we need to be more specific when we talk about that. And I do hope that people have different levels of trust for different levels of media, and maybe they approach cable news differently than their local TV reporter or local newspaper reporter. What's left of that? I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah, and so actually there's some really nice data from Pew Research Center. Again, survey data, so you have to trust that people are reporting their levels of trust in various news outlets and institutions accurately. But there is variation, right? And there's variation ideologically, by age demographic, things like that. And one of the interesting findings that has come out of it, generally speaking, over time, is that people tend to trust local news more than national news outlets or cable news outlets today. They put more trust in these local news sources and in what their friends, family, and neighbors tell them. And I think, you know, this kind of goes back to your case study, but probably in a way that would alarm you, kind of based on what you're saying. But I think, so I think people do sort of think about, they define what counts as news differently, and they sort of do kind of calibrate levels of trust in those ways. It also tends to be the case that people who are more ideologically liberal tend to trust a wider variety of news outlets. Whereas people who are more ideologically conservative tend to kind of consolidate more around the couple of more right-leaning news outlets that are out there today, which I think is not surprising, particularly given, you know, the dominant view of sort of a generally generalized like liberal media bias, or the perception of that anyway. And so, yeah, I mean, I think these are, again, sort of tricky things to evaluate concretely and empirically. But when we do look at the data of what people say they trust, this is kind of what we're seeing, is this increased trust in local news and decreased trust in more nationalized news outlets.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. And, you know, we don't have to turn this into a show of media criticism or media self-criticism. I'm not going to leave the hair shirt in the drawer for now. But, you know, and there are all different ways of media bias, right? There are the people who just come out and say you should believe X, Y, Z. There's the little more insidious version of story selection, right? The fact that
right.
we might do stories about, you know, from the perspective of the abortion issue, right? We might do a story about a woman who couldn't get the care she needed in a red state that had imposed restrictions. We're not doing a story about the 10,000, you know, fetuses that were aborted and some people view as murder, right? So it's this is all the ways, the very subtle ways that media bias works. Let's maybe turn now, and we need to take a break in a few minutes, but I do want to get to this idea of distorted democracy, so which is the crux of your book. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So I argue that because information is changing in this way, and it always has been, this is nothing that's particularly new. I'm just kind of taking the first empirical look at it in this book. When people then rely on other people for information, they become underinformed, meaning that they are less informed than they would have been had they gotten information from the news instead, as well as being more misinformed. So believing things that are not true to be true. So underinformed, polarized, but engaged in politics. And this sort of creates this perfect storm where we have people potentially being more active in politics based on this tattered information that has also led them to have more extreme policy preferences and being potentially more misinformed or at least less informed about the topic at hand, but then ready to sort of go act on that. And this, I think, creates challenges for how we think about what it means for our democracy to function. And in the book, I'm very careful to take this, like, here's the glass half empty view of this, here's the glass half full view of this reality. But I think it, because, you know, on the one hand, we can look at all of these changes happening in our information environment and in how we engage in politics, and sort of we can look at any given election or we can look at any given, you know, whether it's a Supreme Court nominee or a big policy that gets passed or whatever it may be, we can look at these things that are happening and say, okay, but democracy is still functioning, right? So our elections still happened. We still had, you know, nominees were or appointees were still approved. You know, we still had legislation passed. Like, things are still happening on the day to day. So maybe things are not all that bad for how our democracy is supposed to be functioning. And maybe things like a little bit of polarization can actually be good for the American public to be able to have a clearer choice between candidates without needing as much information, right? Like, there are a lot of
you're one of the polarizers. Oh my! All right,
No,
I know you're giving the different perspectives. I'm going to put a pin in that because we do need to take a break. We're on a fixed clock. I'm sorry to cut you off. We will definitely talk more about this when we come back. We are talking with Taylor Carlson, who is the author of the book Through the Grapevine, which looks at how information travels through our modern society and how it gets distorted and how that is potentially distorting our democracy. If you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455. What questions do you have about this? Where do you get your news? Let us know. 800-222-9455. More after a short break. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about information and democracy, how information moves through our society, how it gets distorted as it does, and what the consequences are of that for American self-governance. Our guest for the hour today is Taylor Ann Carlson, who's an associate professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis and the author of Through the Grapevine, Socially Transmitted Information and Distorted Democracy, 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. All right, Taylor, I feel like maybe I sort of unfairly came in there at the end and called you a polarizer. I'll let you...
Just a little bit, which is why I usually frankly, avoid media requests because I don't like the possibility of being twisted into sort of making more broad...
public
comments like that.
Here on public radio, hopefully we have the time to add the nuance that you want to add. So sure. I guess you were making the positive or the sort of the glass half full case for what we've been seeing. I don't know if you have more to say on that.
No, but I do want to again reiterate that this was in none of this am I sharing my perspective, but these are just
fair
perspectives that have been advocated by either other scholars or sort of other people commenting in on these types of issues. So, but there is this perspective that things like polarization can be healthy for democracy, and so maybe. Socially transmitted information can increase, polarization could be viewed as a good thing, right? And I also find in the book that, you know, although people learn less than they would from reading full news articles, for example, they do still learn more than they would have had they chose to seek out no information at all. And so if we think about that as our baseline of sort of like burying your heads in the sand versus learning from your friend versus reading the news on your own, you learn more from asking your friend than just burying your head in the sand. And so that could be viewed as a good thing too. And so it's not necessarily entirely a bad thing. But on the other hand, if we think about the sort of gloom and doom or sort of the what I call the House of Cards version as opposed to the West Wing version of American democracy view of this. The idea here is that then people are sort of unintentionally getting information that is just as bad, if not worse, in terms of being biased and less accurate as the media that they're trying to avoid. And then they're acting on that information, which we could view as a potentially bad thing, right? So this could lead people to vote for more extreme political candidates or vote for more extreme policies in terms of like a ballot amendment or a constitutional amendment or ballot initiative or something like that. Or it could lead people to take more extreme forms of political action, right? And so we could view this as a potentially contributing factor to some of the things that we have seen in society over the past decade or so, maybe longer, where people have really started to question whether our democracy is holding itself together. And so I think it depends on what a democracy really means to you. And that's something that I intentionally do not define in the book, and I will not define for you all today, because I do think it's something that is sort of up to the individual to some extent, right? Like we do, of course, have our political institutions and we want them to hold as strong as they can. But at the same time, we all have our views of what a healthy functioning democracy should be. And we should be able to have open conversations about that. And I think that this socially transmitted information, the way that it can change the way we learn about and engage in politics, can lead us to sort of shift our perspective on what a healthy functioning democracy looks like.
How much is an informed electorate in a key component of a healthy functioning democracy, though, right? I'm thinking of this story. I just Googled it because I wanted to get the numbers right. But back in May, there was this story in the New York Times and other outlets had it as well. 17% of voters blame Biden for the end of Roe, which was the end of the constitutional right to an abortion. That's about one in five voters. This was a swing state survey. One of them was quoted here. I think the buck stops with him. So he had the ability to fight that. And that's not what I'm hearing that he did, said an abortion rights supporter in Las Vegas. And I love that quote, right? Because it goes right to, that's not what I'm hearing that he did, which sounds like, I don't, that could easily be, you know, things that this person was hearing, you know, from her friends and family, maybe.
Sure. So I think this is a question that I actually pose to my undergraduate students in our political psychology class every year. We do a debate. How important is it to be informed? And this is something that scholars have in political science and other fields have debated for a long time. And so I won't share my personal opinion on this, but I will share where the scholarship lands. So this is something where on the one hand, there is a group of scholars who would say, okay, being informed is centrally important to a healthy functioning democracy. People need to have all the information that they can to be able to vote effectively. And otherwise they're voting for candidates who don't support their interests. And there are all these other bad things that could happen. On the other hand, there are scholars who say, okay, but actually there are ways that people can still navigate the political system without needing full information. And so they can use things like heuristics. They can use party ID to try to vote for candidates who probably support most of the policies that they would approve. We can use things like opinion leaders, people within our social networks who we trust and share our general political leanings. And we can say, okay, who do they think I should vote for? They've done their research. They've done their research. They generally share my preferences. I'm just going to go along with what they think I should do. And there are a number of different heuristics that we can use. And when we do that, there are several empirical studies that show, okay, people tend to on average be pretty much as well off as they would have been had they had full information. And so in that case, it is possible that there are enough heuristics out there that we don't need to have full information to still sort of vote in line with our interests. And so, you know, then I think it sort of opens up these old questions that go back to the founding of our country about how important it is to be knowledgeable in order to have the vote and have the right to vote and things like that. And I don't think we will dig into that here today. But I think this is an important question, but I think at the end of the day, we need to at least be thinking about where we are getting information and what that means for how informed we are.
All right. I want to share a couple of more listener comments. We have a caller on the line, but first I'm going to read just briefly an email from Tony in Champaign. I can't see a single mother working at minimum wage profitably reading the New York Times. You almost never make the news understandable and relevant to the uneducated. Why expect them to make the right choice? That's from Tony. And then we have Zach calling from Bloomington on line one. Zach, thank you for calling in.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think? You think that everybody has biases in the news media?
I mean, I do, and not just the news media. I think everyone has biases as a whole, right? I think people don't go through life without a bias. There's no such thing as objectivity in the general sense, right? There is, of course, news that is far out in right field that makes no sense at all, complete speculation, but there's also biased factual reporting, right? I, for one, read People's World. It's a labor paper. It's a pro-worker paper. I know the bias of that. I also know it's generally factual. So I think when we're talking about biases and talking about reporting, we need to add that to the conversation and be aware of it. Like, everyone has a bias. It's a matter of knowing and being able to determine what is fact from fiction. Additionally, just to really quick on the general scope of the larger corporate media, right? I think more and more people are learning with the advent of the internet and just easier access to information that we know these corporations have been compromised in the past, right? The CIA has paid off reporters, has squashed stories, and corporate editors say, hey, we're not running this, right? So that adds to the distrust. I think that's something that's really hard to overcome and also address.
All right, Zach, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Taylor, I don't know if you want to pick up on what Zach said and maybe just in the last few minutes we have of our time together today, what we can do sort of individually, I guess, to try and break these cycles of potentially spreading less than ideal information through our democracy and our society.
Sure. So I really appreciate the call because I think it raises an important point, right? So I absolutely agree. Everyone has biases, right? And I think your example is great where you're saying, I choose this source, but I'm aware of the bias, so I can kind of calibrate in my head, how to interpret that information in context. I think we need to be doing exactly that with our conversations about politics. And so I think we need to try to make sure that we are treating our political conversations as an exchange of information, as if we were reading the news. And I think many people think of them as just, we're just shooting the breeze. This is just small talk, whatever it may be. But that is potentially ignoring the fact that this could be a prime information source for someone. So I think we need what I call in the book, the casually informed people to be, scrutinizing the information that they're getting from other people in the same way that they would information from the media. And we need the actively informed people, as I call them in the book, to be a little more cognizant of the potential impact that they could be having on other people and being careful to say, oh, I'm just sharing my opinion here, as opposed to and really trying to separate, no, this is what I read. And this is what I think about it, to try to make that really explicit for people so that when everyone else is sort of receiving that information, it's very clear what's fact, what's opinion. And then again, trying to make sure that we are sort of treating the information that we exchange with each other socially, perhaps around the Thanksgiving dinner table coming up, as sort of something that we need to think critically about instead of just sort of absorbing as something that's just part of our regular information ecosystem.
All right. So that's individually, just about a minute left. Societally, are there sort of bigger picture things? I know you talk about this in the book that we should be doing to address some of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something that I personally think happens probably more on the individual level. I think that this is something that would be difficult to try to legislate. And so I think this is something about trying to figure out how we can work within the biases that we have and become aware of how these biases can affect our information flows, and both in what we share and receive, the information that we share and the information that we receive as we go forward and try to navigate politics, because politics is both an ever constant, right? Like, some things never seem to change, but the players involved do. And so we need to make sure that we are continuing to update and sort of try to navigate how we engage with information in our changing information environment.
Mm. Very interesting conversation. Taylor Carlson, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me. Happy Thanksgiving.
You as well. Taylor Carlson is Associate Professor of Political Science at Washington University in St. Louis and the author of the book, Through the Grapevine, Socially Transmitted Information in Distorted Democracy. It's from the University of Chicago Press. That's all the time we have for our show today. We do appreciate hearing from you about what we've talked about on air and your suggestions for future guests or stories. Email us, talk@21stshow.org is the address, and you can find that and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. We've got our past episodes there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcast or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or YouTube, wherever you listen. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.